Welcome to Human Rights Unscripted, a podcast run by law students at American University's Washington College of Law.
My name is Kubra Babaturk, and I'm here with my co-producer, Lauren LaVere, and our podcast editors.
I'm Galen Molina.
I'm Sabrina Davis.
And I'm Valerie Cook.
Human Rights Unscripted takes a deep dive into several topics within the human rights field, told candidly by professors, professionals, and even students. Thanks for tuning into the episode, and we hope you all enjoy.
I haven't changed my views about anything since I was about 16. Long time ago.
Professor Herman Schwartz explains.
I just knew when I was about 15 or 16 in high school, I knew I wanted to spend my life in some kind of public interest work. Public interest. It may be that I grew up very much as a Jewish kid in Brooklyn, in a neighborhood that was not particularly friendly to Jews. This is the 1930s. Depression years, people were miserable.
Professor Schwartz takes us through his experiences pre-World War II.
I grew up being informed that although I was born in 1931, I was responsible for all kinds of things that went back 2,000 years. It was a period of very high anti-Semitism in the United States, period when newspapers and others have pointed out the president, who may have been sympathetic to Jewish refugees, politically felt he couldn't do anything. You had very powerful radio speakers. We didn't have television. But you had organizations. The neighborhood in which I lived had a German-American, basically Nazi party post a few blocks from my house. Mm-hmm. My father had tried to get his younger brother out of a family of 7-8, but couldn't get him a visa, couldn't get him within the quota, even though the quota was underfilled because of what happened in those days, mm-hmm. as you may or not know. The anti-Semitism in the State Department was very powerful, went all the way up to the Undersecretary of State. People who helped Jews get out of Europe, not just in the United States, but elsewhere, suffered for it professionally. That was the media in which I grew up. And I don't really know what induced me. It would sound as if, you know, that's a real, write a book, that's how he grew up, little Herman. But my brother didn't react that way, the way I did. Mm-hmm. Those were all parts of my formative years, mm-hmm. as a kid and in college and law school. Then my second year in law school, first year, Brown came down. So the world began to change. McCarthy was blown away, died an alcoholic death somewhere. People began to forget, but of course the victims were still there. So then I followed the tried and true path, nothing particularly adventurous, which was I applied for a clerkship. I got one on the Second Circuit, joined a big law firm, spent two truly miserable years. I knew I wanted to be and was an antitrust lawyer. Mm-hmm. That would be, I actually hope to, when I graduate from law school, to go down to Washington to join the Justice Department, mm-hmm. which under Eisenhower, surprisingly, and this was repeated under Nixon, had an antitrust division that was, for some reason, being very active. Not the thing you usually find when there's a Republican administration. But you did in the latter 1950s, and then again in the early years of Nixon's administration. The Federal Trade Commission was beefed up and so on. Spent two miserable years there working on one big case. Mm-hmm. Joined a small firm that a senator from New York had started. In those days, senators practiced law. Lived a very high life. We were in the Seagram building in New York. We were very small, but we were very luxurious. We had some very good clients. It helps to have a senator's name. Right. I had a marvelous time. Was in court a lot, unlike working on one big case. Found out I liked that kind of stuff and decided I wasn't going to do that working on ordinary private stuff. I enjoyed it a lot. I loved and still did until the early 90s when I stopped doing litigation and that sort of thing. Decided that I would go into law teaching. Part of the reason is, the first thing that happened is a friend of this already introduced to the Washington World, a friend of Senator Estes Kefauver, a friend of my wife's father, was close to Estes Kefauver of Tennessee, who headed the Antitrust Committee. I had just gotten married, which at the age of 27, 28. In those days, I was already sentenced in the eyes of most people to lifelong bachelorhood. In those days, my wife was the very, very over the hill age of 25. And we decided after I had spent about a year and a half or 2 years with this small law firm, I had learned as much of the trade in that capacity as I could. Mm-hmm. And the big firm set very high standards. That was, I don't know if I adhered to them, but everything, and we had a particularly god-awful guy who headed the department, but he was a stickler. In those days, you didn't have Xerox machines, things like that, copiers, so you had carbon copies. So if he found a comma out of place, you had to redo the whole goddamn thing in 15 copies or things like that. There was it used to be this funny scene of senior partners going into a conference room with 15 copies of a brief and then stationing themselves around the room and collating by hand. You know, wow. It was a different world. Yeah. It was, you know, practically a log cabin on Park Avenue. So I spent 2 years in Washington with the Antitrust Committee. I don't know, have you ever seen or heard of Professor Kittery, who's here?
I've heard of him.
Yeah, and the faculty lounge is named for him. Well, he was on the same committee for one of the Republicans, so I've known him ever since, I guess, 60 years or something like that. So then after about 2 years, Senator Kefauver died of a heart attack that he suffered on the floor of the Senate, and I was with him at the time. And it was clear, because the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Kefauver was head of the Antitrust Committee, and the subcommittee. The head of the committee was James Eastland, who was a rabid segregationist from Mississippi, mm-hmm. had a plantation, a real nasty guy, and it was very clear my days were numbered. This was 1963. I left Washington on the day of the march on, the day after the March on Washington. I was at the rally at which King spoke. I must confess, he spoke late in the afternoon. I watched it on television after that. And I had decided sometime in the winter of 1963, before this, that I could basically do what I wanted to do, which was to be actively involved in working on domestic human rights mm-hmm. and the like. A lot of law professors were getting involved. And so for the next 14 or 15 years, initially, I was not involved in the international sphere. Mm-hmm. I taught, did civil rights work. I don't know if you know about my prison involvement. Yeah. That came about because the ACLU, I was very close to them by then. Right. I wasn't applying for an internship. The head of it, one of the truly great figures in human rights, both domestic and international, Arye Nair. I had been working with him since 1967. And doing prison work, my prison work, you'll be interested to know, was financed by the Playboy Foundation. I received two copies every month of Playboy, mm-hmm. went to a party at the Playboy Mansion. It wasn't all grubby stuff or sitting at a typewriter or something like that. And Hugh Hefner, by the way, this was at a conference we held about 3 months after Attica on prisons, mm-hmm. National conference. Mm-hmm. And then that night, there was the party at the Playboy Mansion. My mother-in-law, who was then widowed, came with us. Hefner grabbed all the guys and women who were doing prison work mm-hmm. and just bent their ear for 2 hours. Just kept asking questions mm-hmm. and so on, distracting from the scene around us, which was very troubling to many of us. So Arye was at the ACLU. Into the early 1980s, and I did prisons and civil school segregation. I went south for a summer, part of the summer, did school cases. This was after Nixon was elected, lost every one of them, had all kinds of exchanges with Southern judges, who reminded me that I wasn't up, as one of them put it, you're not in the North, Mr. Schwartz. R.A. left the ACLU, and around 1985, in a way totally unconnected, I was asked to go to Russia, sort of clandestinely, with my wife and a friend who was one of the leaders of the leadership conference on civil rights, to talk to Jews who were then being ostracized and persecuted by Gorbachev, actually, in 85, until he switched radically. So that was my first experience abroad. REA took over something called Helsinki Watch. Do you know about Helsinki Watch? The Helsinki Agreements and different organizations were set up. REA is one of the great organizational geniuses of our time. The things that he's created after a while with Soros's billions. REA contacted me about, no, I guess the first thing was Professor Ohrenflicker, who was then working for Human Rights Watch, and I, and a federal judge named Marvin Frankel, and a young guy who was financing the project I did about Israel, which you probably know, went to interview kids who'd been involved in the first intifada in Israel, who'd been arrested, rocks throwing, things like that. That was for what was then called Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. I think Mike Posner was the general counsel. That was one of the early things that Professor Ohrenflicker did. I had known her because I had known her father. So that was the first thing I did. We prepared a report on prisoner treatment, which never saw the light of day, I think. And then REA called me in about 1987 or 88 and said, I'd like you to form a committee to look at prisons around the world, including prisons behind the Iron Curtain and anywhere else. Well, obviously, from my work in prisons, I knew most of the players, and so we formed a committee. And that's how I got directly involved in international human rights in a meaningful way. The first trip I made was to Poland, very clandestine. People met us at the airport. First names only, safe place. It was all very exciting. No, the communists, the Russians, the Poles couldn't care less. I later found out I had been interviewing people in Czechoslovakia. We interviewed ex-prisoners because, of course, they weren't going to let us in. So we interviewed ex-prisoners. I later found out that the couch on which I had been sitting at my interpreter's house in Prague, interviewing ex-prisoners, had been bugged. Nobody bothered me. So the first trip, which I went to with my wife, was in Poland. And I prepared a report, which was issued. I put together a committee of people, pros in the prisons field, essentially in American prisons, former commissioner of corrections in New York City, a very good guy named Ben Malcolm. There was a problem at Rikers Island. Oh, I had been involved as head of a state commission that investigated prisons. One of my students, who was in the governor's office, had sort of written it for me when a Democratic governor came in. Unfortunately, it got caught up in party politics, and I was shot down by a party line vote. I had to be confirmed. But we went to Poland, then to Czechoslovakia. This is before the Iron Curtain. Made a lot of friends at this time in the human rights community there. I remember in Prague, we were given a copy, not given, we were shown a copy of a sort of newsletter for human rights people that was circulated. I was about to put it in my briefcase, and the woman who showed it to me said, no, we circulate these. These circulate, we don't have enough to give away. It was that kind of thing. I personally did about 4, 5, 6 reports. Ultimately, when the Iron Curtain fell, we went to Russia before it imploded. Mm-hmm. That was when Gorbachev was still calling the shots. He had a reformer on Russian prisons, so we were invited. I then got a call from the Polish embassy saying, we understand you're interested in prisons. I said, well, of course, yeah. He said, you've been to Poland before, haven't you? I said, yeah. He said, you went in on a tourist visa. You didn't do much touristing, was our impression. I said, well, I saw a fair amount, that kind of thing. So then I went to the worst place I've ever seen, was in a jail in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and a jail in Russia, in St. Petersburg, I think. There's one of the great poems of any language about that prison, written by a great Russian woman poet, Anna Akhmatova, called Kresty. It's a prison in this shape, mm-hmm. and she was online, and it's, I think it was called Requiem, something mm-hmm. like that. So that's how I got into it. Mm-hmm. And then in December of 1989, my wife and I took a trip over Christmas. And since I had been in some of these countries, I wanted to see what was happening. The Iron Curtain had fallen. Mm-hmm. And I had made some friends of people who were professors of constitutional law in places like Prague, and mostly there. And Václav Havel, we arrived. My interpreter, who later became the ambassador to the United States, who was going to meet us at the airport, said, why don't you come to the Magic Lantern? Magic Lantern is a special art form. Multimedia, humans, movies, curtains. Václav Havel, the great figure, who that's him, was going to give a talk and come and listen. So we did. We met some of the law professors we met earlier. They were involved in drafting a new constitution. And I said, I'd be very happy to work with you if you think it would do any good. And they said, yes, of course. And so for the next 3 years, I spent doing a hell of a lot of travel. The school was very good about this. I managed to cover the classes with makeups. I went everywhere from Outer Mongolia to Prague to Budapest, Georgia. Even once got in a trip to Paris. But mostly it was places that were Yerevan in the summer, in Armenia, electricity for 1 hour a day, 2 hours a day, Georgia the same thing. As you can see, this kind of wandered. Opportunities came. The school was very, very helpful. I worked with people who had no money problems because you had Soros and you had State Department contracts. So they would cover my expenses. And then some Texas billionaire said to one of the groups I was working with, the Charter 77 group, this was very high society stuff, said to the woman who was working with us, a real dynamo of a woman, who among other things left her marriage to run off with the American ambassador to Prague, who left his marriage. So these people were very, very well connected with money. Mm-hmm. The guy from Texas, a billionaire, said to this woman, Wendy Lures, said to Wendy, what are you working on? She said, I'm working with a bunch of guys, Lloyd Cutler, or Wilma Cutler, with whom I did some of this stuff. I'm working with Lloyd Cutler and some others on constitutional reform and human rights in Eastern Europe. He said, do you need money? She said, yeah. How much do you need? She said, we had put together a budget about $120,000 or $30,000 for travel expenses. She said, about $200,000. She said, okay, you'll get a check in a week or so. And she did. We were able to do a lot. What's left of it now, I don't know. Apparently, Slovakia isn't too bad. I worked a lot in Slovakia, as well as in the Czech Republic. I guess about the mid-90s, I pretty much stopped and have spent the years since writing and teaching, essentially. At Human Rights Watch, which is where Nair wound up, well, not wound up, then at the Open Society, he formed a special group called the Justice Initiative, the founding members of which were Professor Mendez, Professor Orenflicker, and myself were among the 10 or 12 founding members. Meanwhile, Nair worked very closely with Professor Goldman on Latin American issues because Nair first took over at Latin America Watch. I went to Cuba with him to look at Cuban prisons. There was a brief period when Castro felt he was under the gun. He cleaned up the prisons, invited us. So I went with Arie to Cuba, to Havana, and people just mobbed him there when he came, because he had created this thing called Latin America Watch. Then he took over Human Rights Watch. And then Soros said to him, I'd like you to come and build this thing up, and he did, and that was about 2001, something like that. So the three of us and Bob Goldman working independently with REA on Latin American issues. So that's why one of the things I've always said when I used to give talks to entering students for the Human Rights Center, the great thing about this place is that unlike most places, practically all other places, the people who do the teaching here are involved directly and at the same time in working directly on these problems. So what you get is a very practical as well as theoretical, because this is an area that lends itself to that sort of thing. So yeah. I'm retiring.
Well, I mean, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but you mentioned a lot of your work has been with prisons, and I'd like to go back to kind of how you, like, with Attica, your work with Attica, and then that led to the founding of the National Prison Project. What kind of, like, impact did that have on your life, on your career, personally, or...
I don't know. At a minimum, I would say, transformed it.
Yeah.
What happened was when I started teaching, criminal procedure. I didn't do constitutional law until I came here. So this was, I started teaching in 63. And I started to teach criminal procedure right from the beginning, which I did, I think, until the mid-90s or maybe. And this was in Buffalo. And this was a period when we really thought we could change the world. It's before the real reaction set in. I was at the State University of New York in Buffalo. The New York State Legislature formed a committee to look into prisons. They asked me to serve on it as one of about 8 or 10 people. I guess that's almost how it started. And it was very clear to me that there was no law. Federal courts, still the high point of federalism, didn't want to mix into state courts. State judges, everything is administrative. I started to work with on civil liberties and civil rights as soon as I got to into teaching, 64, 65, 63, and I got involved with the ACLU almost as soon. And after visiting some prisons, I decided that, modestly, there was no law where prisons were concerned, and I would try to do something about that. And at this time, there was a lawsuit in New York by a guy named Something Wright, who was at a place called Dannemora, which is near the New York-Canadian line. And somehow or other, a woman, a lawyer in, I think around Rochester, had brought a lawsuit on his behalf. Turned out conditions were ghastly. He was put into a room without windows during the winter. In upstate New York, temperature drops to about 10 or 15 below, beatings, everything. Mm-hmm. And the court held in his favor, Second Circuit. Mm-hmm. It's about 1968, 69. I spent a year at Michigan, which was a very good school. I was teaching for a year. Mm-hmm. But was very, very academic. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't that kind of academic. So I talked to my friend Nyer, who was there with the New York Civil Liberties Union, and I said to him, Arye, I think I'd like to start bringing some suits, some lawsuits. Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of judges here. One's a near fascist, and the other is a good guy. And he said, great. And while we were planning this, he became director of the American Civil Liberties Union. And he said, what do we need in terms of money? I said, well, you know, I can probably file papers in Foma Pauperis, but, you know, I've got to pay a stenographer. I've got to do things like that. The school isn't going to pay for this. Mm-hmm. State school, among other things. So that's when he contacted his friend at Playboy. Playboy was very much involved with First Amendment issues. Mm-hmm. That is the key part of the ACLU. And the guy who was the executive director of the Playboy Foundation was a lawyer whose wife was executive director of the ACLU in Chicago. So we started with a lawsuit involving due process. I started with a lawsuit actually on safety in the metal shop, which was terribly dangerous. They didn't have guards or anything. File a lawsuit. I get the wrong judge. I'm thrown out all my year. I file another suit on a bunch of guys who had been involved, who literally were involved in the Attica thing, in Fracas at Auburn Prison near Rochester. Mm-hmm. Transferred to Attica, and immediately thrown into segregation, solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. Well, we looked at the rules. I had a student working with me. We looked at the rules, and the rules said nobody can put into that in segregation mm-hmm. without getting a hearing first from the superintendent. Mm-hmm. Insofar as any such hearings were held, they were held by the principal, deputy superintendent, not known as the PK, the principal keeper. The warden didn't run the prison. The principal keeper did. And you had this situation of where the warden had this beautiful house, gardens tended by inmates. So we go to court. I remember it's about Christmas season. And I say, Judge, the rules are very clear. I happened to get the liberal guy, who incidentally was a wonderful man, died about 6 months ago at the age of 94. Mm-hmm. Front page story on USA Today about the fact that when a bunch of Buffalo war resistors came before him for having broken into a draft ward or something, pouring blood, I don't know what they did, but they did it, mm-hmm. and they were convicted. And he said, you did this, you broke the law, you so-and-so, I'm going to give you a 5-year sentence, I have no choice, sentence suspended. Never served a day in prison. Yeah. Front page on USA Today. Mm-hmm. We saw it while my wife and I were visiting our daughter in New York. So he said, that's absolutely right. There's got to be a hearing. That really shook up the system. And he said, it's got to be done by the superintendent himself. Blessed be he. So that's how it started. Mm-hmm. Now, I wasn't the only one. There was a wonderful lawyer on the West Coast for the Legal Defense Fund, a guy named Bill Turner, who had brought a big case against the entire Texas juvenile prison system, Bill William Bennett Turner. The Legal Defense Fund in the East, in New York, had jumped into this, and the head of the New York City Legal Aid Society Appeals Division had also gotten involved. And the three of us were handling most of the big cases in the East, and Turner and a couple of women were involved in the West. And that's how it started. Then, about 3 or 4 years later, a guy named Al Bronstein, one of the great civil rights lawyers, had gone down to Jackson, Mississippi in 1964. And there had been another lawyer, a guy who's still practicing around here, Phil Hirschkopf, in Alexandria. He's a big animal rights lawyer. Do you remember the case of Loving against Virginia? Mm-hmm. He handled that case 2 years out of law school in the Supreme Court.
Wow.
I don't know if he wore his cowboy boots to court, but he did. A rather flamboyant character. So Arye said to me, Al Bronstein is thinking of coming north again. He had been down there for the Lawyers Constitutional Defense Committee. He was in Jackson, I was in New Orleans, but I was there very briefly during the summers, handling about 4 or 5 school cases. But he was down there living, probably dodging bullets occasionally, that kind of thing. So I said, look, it makes perfect sense. I can't operate on a national level. I've got 2 law students with me helping. And I can't take a big case. I can take paper cases, motions, hearings, but I can't take a big trial. I wouldn't know how. Mm-hmm. And that's what Al did. So I became, together with Hirschkopf, co-chairs of the National Prison Project, which is still operating today. So that's how I got involved in it. It was in the air between 1969, 70, and 1974. We kept winning in the Supreme Court. I argued 2 cases in the Supreme Court. I won the first, even though I technically lost it. My client lost, I won. The issue in the case was, it was a procedural case, whether or not we had to go to state courts first, which would have been a disaster because all the state courts at that time were filled with district attorneys. Or could we go right into federal court under Civil Rights Act of 1871, a 1983 case against state officials. This is worth telling you as an anecdote. My guy was a guy from New York. He was writing in a diary. And in the diary he wrote, the nurse who comes around is a really good-looking woman. I would like to get into her or something, that kind of thing. A guard comes along, sees the diary, seizes the diary. Lawsuit. I was called in for some reason at the Supreme Court stage. I don't know why. The guy who handled it was a guy from Syracuse I knew. And he said, would you take it? I said, yeah. Well, there was no money in it. So I argued the case. What happened was he lost 10 days good time. And so he then goes out to San Francisco. And we argued the case, and the court comes back in a major case called Prizer against Prizer Rodriguez. Yeah. And the court says, if it's a conditions issue, you go into federal court on the 1983. You don't have to go to state court. If it's a question of liberty, that's what habeas corpus is all about. In this case, it's about liberty. It's 10 days good time. Mm-hmm. So, point, I lose. My friend calls me from New York and says, from Washington, I was in New York, and says, called up, he was a kind of eccentric guy, he calls up and says, you lost. I said, what did they say? They said, if it's liberty, habeas corpus, 1983, your guy lost. So what are you talking about? I won. I was interested in prison conditions. Yeah. I mean, somebody else was interested in the question. Mm-hmm. So it was the 10 days. Mm-hmm. I got a call from the New York State Attorney General who had argued against me. She said, Herman, I'm not going to send out two sheriff's deputies to San Francisco to bring a guy back for 10 days. Case closed, no costs. 2 weeks later, I get a big bundle of fruit and cheese and everything. Turns out the guy is a nephew of the guy who owns Zabar's in New York, the delicatessen. That was my fruit.
Oh, wow.
So we couldn't lose in those days until 1974, when I argued a case that about whether prisoners could be interviewed, and lost 5-4. And then Rehnquist in 1979, 80, Bell against Wolfish came down with a dreadful decision and made things very difficult. That's the thing about it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for...
Yeah, we don't want to keep you any longer.
We don't want an old guy who likes to...
No, thank you so much. Yeah. This has been absolutely great. I've really enjoyed sitting down to get to talk to you.
Yeah, so much.
I can tell you, when I was at my second law firm, mm-hmm. the firm gave me all the time I wanted to do pro bono work. It can be done.
Yeah.
Right.
One of my closest friends was a guy who did very well as a lawyer and was one of the leading lawyers during the Vietnam period for drafts and others. He had his own law firm, did very, very well.
Yeah.
You don't have to take an oath of poverty.
No. Right.
But you do have to take an oath to pay back.
In your career.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. It was wonderful meeting you. Thank you.
Take care. Have a good rest of your day.